Hello, I'm Bill Redman.
And I'm Tony Faust.
Welcome to Odin and Aesop, the podcast where we review military history books to help understand the events and ideas of the past. Some of these events and ideas still shape our world today. If you're interested in learning more about the show, want to get a hold of us, or provide some feedback, just visit our website where we've got links to related material and contact information. Just Google Odin and Aesop, all one word. We'd love to hear from you. You can also follow us on Twitter.
In this episode, Bill and I will review Hans Ulrich Rudel's Stuka Pilot. It's an autobiography that documents Rudel's 4 years in combat and how he became the most decorated member of the German military during World War II. The book provides an interesting look at the titanic struggle on the Eastern Front. It also provides us a chance to look at the Luftwaffe's contributions to the development of close air support during the war and how close air support is utilized on today's battlefields. So that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. But before we get into tonight's book, what's been going on, Bill?
Well, I finished up my first run of homemade kimchi. I'm not bragging. Just going to say it kicked righteous homemade stuffed in a jar of kimchi ass. I even caramelized the last part as an impossible vegan cheeseburger topping. So I'm the man.
So where'd you get your recipe for your kimchi from?
From my sister. And it's not authentic. She's not Korean, but anyhow.
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, the Koreans have a word called sonmut, which is, they call it, the translation is hand taste, right? And that's how a lot of their cooking is done, meaning the cook just has a feel for it and they throw in ingredients to get what they want. And kimchi is made that way by most people. And it's a recipe that's handed down from generation to generation. And no two really taste exactly the same. So that's really interesting. And we'll have to try it once we get that thing done.
All right. Well, I didn't know that, but I did find out. Apparently, the cabbage kimchi that we all know and love today is relatively new. I guess cabbage is not native to the peninsula. It was introduced in the 1800s. They'd been fermenting it everything for hundreds of years before that, but cabbage is new. So what do you got?
Yeah, you know, it's super good for your digestive system because it's a natural probiotic, right?
I did know that, man. My gut health is off the charts right now. So, but that's me. What have you been reading? What do you got going on?
Oh, okay. Well, I just finished a couple of books. One is Jack Kleiss's book. He's the dive bomber pilot I talked about in the first episode that flew with Scouting Squadron 6 off the Enterprise. His distinction is that he was the only guy during the Battle of Midway to successfully put three bombs into three capital ships of the Japanese. So on June 4th in the morning, he was able to put a bomb into Kaga, which is a Japanese aircraft carrier. And then after returning to the Enterprise and rearming and refueling, they went out again. What was left of them, because there was a lot of them that didn't make it back, what was left of them went back out in the afternoon strike, and he put a bomb into Hiryu, which is also another Japanese carrier. They had a day off on the 5th, and then they struck the Japanese rear guard on the 6th of June. And on that raid, he put another bomb into the Japanese cruiser Maekuma. So all of that won him a Navy Cross and was a pretty good day for him.
Well, as long as he wraps it up by putting it in his weekly TPS report, I'm sure things will go fine for him.
Yeah, I'm sure he's going to get that stapler back, too. But I would just tell you, this is an interesting side note about this. Did you know that during World War II, if you were a Navy pilot and you put a bomb or torpedo into a capital ship, you got a Navy Cross?
I did not know that.
And for the listeners out there, the Navy Cross is the second highest award you can get in the Marine Corps or Navy. And so at the end of the war, interestingly enough, as the Japanese ships were all tied up to the pier because they had no fuel to take them out to sea, like their old aircraft carriers and stuff, and they would do these strikes in late 1945, the Navy guys were rolling in hard trying to shove a bomb down the stack because they were trying to get a Navy Cross.
I didn't know that.
Pretty interesting, though. Anyways, so I finished that book. I also finished The Magnificent Bastard by Keith Nolan, which is a book about 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, and their fight against the 320th NVA Division. They fought a three-day battle at Daidu, which is north of Donghao, which is right up on the DMZ. Anyways, it's a really little-known battle in the Marine Corps and should be studied and known to a much greater extent in the Marine Corps. Interestingly, I did get a hold of General Weiss, who was the battalion commander of 2-4 during that battle, and hopefully I will be able to get him on a call. He lives in Virginia, so we can talk about that book and the battle. So I'm pretty excited about that. Hey, looks like we got at least one mail. So why don't we read that for the listeners and see what came in the mail?
All right. Well, we got Bob from Colorado ask, I can get my head around your Odin and Aesop title. You two were not very deep or clever on your thinking there. Okay. But what's up with the two birds that seem to be everywhere?
Bob, that's a fantastic question. I had the exact same question for Bill a couple of weeks ago because I was a little concerned when I started really looking at the graphics, and I saw the Norse in the birds, and I was a little concerned we might have an Asian tat issue. I used to talk to my Marines about this all the time. They'd have an Asian tat, and I'd go, hey, what's that say? And they'd always like, it's warrior strength or something. I go, well, how are you sure it doesn't say, like, punch me in the face, or I'm an a-hole? And they would always assure me that they had researched it. And so I had a similar concern. And I asked Bill, can you look up, because I don't speak Norse, can you look that up so we're not on the wrong side of that?
Well, I did look it up, and I think we're good. But here's the deal on the Ravens. They are Huggin and Munin, or Munin. I don't know how the Vikings pronounced it. But what they do, according to Norse mythology, is they fly around and they see what's going on in the world. Then they fly back to where they perch on Odin's shoulders, and they tell him what's going on. So that is one thing that gives Odin a leg up on things, is he knows what's happening.
So Aesop doesn't get any cool birds. He's just hanging around.
Pretty much. He's the Greek fable teller. So, in modern times, he would probably be a podcaster.
Or a disc jockey.
Something like that. But here's the really clever part with the Ravens. Munin or Munin means memory, and Huggin means thought. Now, when you combine them, this memory or knowledge of the world, with thought, you get wisdom. So you see how that works? So, well, thank you for that, Bob. And please keep the questions coming either on email or Twitter.
Well, that's fantastic. You've allayed all my fears, which I had, Bill. And I think, you know, because you're the one who came up with that, it was a little deeper than I thought, so fantastic job on that. I give you big kudos because you have a little bit more artistic flair than I do myself.
I'm going next level.
Anyways, so Bob, thanks for that email. Please keep them coming out there so that we can answer your questions if you have any. And you can certainly bring up comments or suggestions on how to make the podcast better. So, Bill, how about we get into the heart of the matter on Stuka Pilot today? So if you could start us off with the operational setting so we know kind of what Hans Rudel is dealing with.
Germany invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941. Why'd Hitler do it? After all, it proved to be his undoing. Well, he had some reasons which made sense in his evil mind. First, he viewed Soviet Bolshevism as his archenemy. Wasn't shy about saying it, and he also wasn't shy about his ambitions to expand German territory to the east. Second, during World War I, Germany and the Central Powers defeated the Russians in the east, but they lost to the French, British, and other allies in the west. Hitler reversed that outcome in May and June of 1941 when he defeated the French and British. He drove the British off the continent, and he occupied France. To completely reverse the verdict of defeat in World War I, all Germany needed to do was go defeat the Russians, now Soviets, again. The Soviet Army's recent poor performance fighting the Finnish, compared with Germany's lightning-fast, lopsided victories against Poland and France, made German victory over the Soviets look like a pretty safe bet. Lastly, Germany needed the resources. So Hitler rolled the dice, and on June 21, 1941, Germany and its allies invaded the Soviet Union. The operation, named Barbarossa, involved over 3 million troops attacking along a 1,800-mile-long front. At first, the German army looked unstoppable. They advanced hundreds of miles all the way to the outskirts of Moscow, but they lost about 775,000 casualties along the way, and by December, they stalled. Meanwhile, the Soviets suffered over 800,000 dead and an additional 6 million wounded or captured. Those numbers just boggle the mind. They were just getting started, though. This was just the first couple months. Tens of millions of more perished before it was over. The tide shifted with Soviet victory at Stalingrad in early 1943, and it ended in May 1945 with the Soviets, who had advanced all the way back from Moscow to Berlin, digging through the rubble looking for Hitler's charred remains. The Eastern Front accounted for something like 75-80% of all German equipment and personnel losses during World War II. It's what broke the back of Hitler's army. With evil men like Hitler and Stalin as opposing leaders, neither side really made much pretense about observing the niceties of international law or letting humanitarian concerns into their thinking. Add in the Russian winters, and the Eastern Front became an unending hellscape. One man who was there throughout all of it was Germany's most highly decorated soldier and the world's most experienced combat aviator, Hans Ulrich Rudel. We're going to talk about his autobiography. Before we do that, we think it's important to note that Rudel was an unrepentant Nazi, and he died as one in 1982.
Yeah, Bill, the scale of the Eastern Front always blows my mind. An 1,800-mile front, that's like the distance from Minot, North Dakota, to South Padre Island in Texas. We're talking about a front that covers the widest portion of the U.S. north to south. It's very, very difficult to defend all that terrain, and you're going to need to shift units from one spot to another as the situation develops. Because of this, Rudel and his Stuka squadron were always getting shuttled to critical locations to support offensive and defensive operations. In addition, because Germany's fly-until-you-die policy, Rudel was able to participate in all the major battles that took part on the Eastern Front. He was always there. By participating in every major campaign, Rudel provides the readers of this book a running narrative on the Eastern Front. From the heady days of 1941, where the German victory felt assured, to the last gasp of the Third Reich, Stuka Pilot provides its readers a panorama of the entire war in the East. In the book, Rudel provides narration on his participation in 11 major campaigns. Places like Leningrad, Moscow, Stalingrad, Kursk, the Courland Pocket, the defense of Budapest and Prague. He was there for all of it. From the summer of 1941 to the spring of 1945, he was in constant combat in all the major hotspots the Germans had. To give some context to this, this would be like a Marine fighter pilot or attack pilot being at Pearl Harbor when it was attacked, then going out to the Philippines, defending that until it falls, providing support for the following landings: Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Kwajalein, Saipan, Guam, Peleliu, the Philippines, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, and then throw in a couple of attacks on mainland Japan from carriers. So bottom line, by reading this book, you get a good feel for the flow of the war in the Eastern Front. The book is packed with interesting subjects and stories. For the book review portion of the podcast, I'm just going to concentrate on three. First, let's start with Rudel's description of his introduction to the Luftwaffe and his activities during the first 18 months of the war. He joins the military in 1936 as an officer cadet in the Luftwaffe. As he's ending his officer training, Goring shows up to his class and asks for volunteers to join the Stuka squadrons that he is forming. Rudel didn't really get the word on not volunteering, so he raises his hand and is selected. The rest of the class is assigned to be fighter pilots shortly afterwards. This is a bit of a kick in the sack for the young motivator, Rudel. So he starts his training as a Stuka pilot in 1938. Pretty quickly, he's labeled as a slow learner by the flight instructors. Overall, the flight instructors and the squadron commander that he was training under were not impressed with him. In addition, his earnestness slash clean living habits didn't endure him to his peers or superiors either. Working out, doing sport, as the Germans like to say, drinking milk, or not being a player with the ladies put him kind of on the outside of his community. You have to realize there's a social component within the aviation community in general. It's always been part of advancement and acceptance. Obviously, you have to be able to fly and be tactically sound, but in addition, you have to be one of the guys in order to fit into that ready room or squadron. Rudel was never considered an insider. So in 1939, the Stuka community had been tasked to supply a couple of officers for reconnaissance training. Rudel's name was put on that list and he was shipped off. However, when he takes his high altitude medical exam, he fails. So they send him right back to the Stuka community. Instead of being assigned to a flying billet, he is assigned to man a desk in the training command. command. He remains there for almost a year and a half. Finally, he is sent to a Stuka squadron in 1940. The squadron he is assigned to is in southern Greece, and they're preparing for the invasion of Crete. Anyways, he arrives at the squadron and checks in with the squadron adjutant, who just happens to be his old instructor pilot. His instructor pilot then goes talks to the CO, and he's grounded. At this point, he's desperate to get in the fight. Shortly after that, his squadron commander sends him to be a ferry pilot. So what he's doing is he's ferrying aircraft that have been in the maintenance depot to operational squadrons. And he's flying airplanes from the depot to Stuka squadrons that are participating in the invasion of Russia. Eventually, one of the squadron commanders invites him to stay with his unit and prove himself, which he does. Within a couple of months, he sinks the Soviet battleship Murat and starts his career as an operational pilot. I suspect those 18 months generated a burning desire within Rudell to prove himself, as well as shove his record down the throats of those who doubted him when he first started. I'm also sure it fueled him throughout the war. It's a little bit like Tom Brady, who spent 20 years demonstrating to the NFL how wrong they were to draft him in the sixth round. In the last episode, we talked a little bit about escape and evasion. Stuka pilot provides another example of what it's like to be on the run behind enemy lines. Rudell spends a considerable amount of time describing an escape and evasion he went through in March of 1944. The scene starts with Rudell and his squadron flying near Moldova, which is between Ukraine and Romania. It's the eighth mission of the day, and one of the young pilots is forced down after he took some anti-aircraft fire. So Rudell makes the decision to land near the downed crew, pick them up, and then take off again. Well, his aircraft gets stuck in the mud. Him and his gunner try all kinds of things to get it loose, but it just won't budge. So as they look out, they see that there's some Soviet soldiers headed their way, so they know that they've got no other choice but make a run for it. So they're about 4 miles from a major river, which is the Dniester. And so they jump out of the aircraft, and all four of the pilot and the gunners all head off towards the river. So they're running for 4 miles. They get there, and it turns out that the river has actually got a cliff to it. So they have to negotiate their way down the cliff, which is basically they just jump, and they use the brush and trees to break their fall as they go down the cliff. Well, they get to the bottom, they take off their shoes and some other stuff, and they start the 600-yard swim across the river. Now, you have to remember, it's March of 1944, and so the water temperature of the river is between 38 and 40 degrees. Anyways, Rudell makes a decision, which I find really interesting, to get rid of his shoes but save his medals, right? So he puts his medals in his pocket and throws his shoes away, gets into the water. Well, of the four people that jump into the water, only three of them make it across. Rudell's gunner ends up drowning on the trip because he goes probably hypothermic. Anyways, so they get to the other side. They dry up a little bit, and they start heading out. And pretty quickly, some Soviet soldiers show up, and they're trying to determine if Rudell and the rest of the guys are Germans or Russians. And they pretty quickly determine that they're German. So they say, okay, the jig is up. You're captured. Rudell makes an immediate decision. I'm not going to hang out with this because it's just not going to happen. So he just bolts. So he takes off running. The Soviet soldiers are shooting at him and running after to chase him. Eventually they hit him in the shoulder, but they don't catch him. So he runs and runs and runs, and a whole bunch of other Soviet soldiers show up, and they're searching and searching and searching for him. It's starting to get dark. He hides in a potato field, which is plowed, and it has just enough undulation where it's getting dark enough they don't see him. So unbelievably, even though there's a Soviet soldier within, 10 or 15 feet of him, they don't find him. Well, he walks the rest of that night, or a large portion of the night, finds a Russian house, stops, gets a little bit of food from one of the Russian or Soviet peasants, and then takes off again. Well, he ends up walking an additional 25 to 30 miles without shoes, and eventually gets back to German lines. Now, what's crazy about this story is within a week, he's back in the cockpit. So you got to remember, he got a bullet through the shoulder and his feet are completely trashed. But within a week, he's back flying again. And he describes it how he had to have people carry him to the aircraft on the day he started flying again. So that, because he couldn't walk there because his feet were too messed up. He ends up flying 6 missions that day. Anyways, what was bizarre to me is that no one else in the German military seemed it was unusual for a guy who got shot in the shoulder and who's got feet he could barely walk on to go back up and fly 6 missions a week after he gets back. So that was Rudell's description of his E&E. Lastly, Rudell does a great job at describing what it's like to attack Soviet ground formations from the air. He provides considerable detail on how he used an anti-tank variant of the Stuka to destroy over 500 tanks in the last 2 years of the war. His approach was to attack the rear of the tank, where the armor was the thinnest, and get extremely close before firing. He usually closed to within 300 feet before firing his cannons. He had to do this because the two 37mm cannons his aircraft was armed with only carried 6 rounds of ammunition apiece. The cannons fired as a pair, so Rudel could only destroy 6 tanks per mission. Accuracy was key, so he would get as close as possible to the targets before he opened fire. For him, a perfect mission was a quick 6 kills, and he would return to base, rearm, and get back to the front as quickly as possible. Remember, many times his airplanes were all that stood between the Soviet armor columns and his squadron's airfield. There were at least 4 times in the book where Rudel describes being forced to defend his airfield from the air without significant help from ground forces. Although Rudel's views are completely delusional at times, the fact that he had a ringside seat for the entire war on the Eastern Front makes Stuka Pilot a must-read. You really get a feel for the scale and ferocity of combat on the Eastern Front by reading Rudel's description of them. Stuka Pilot also provides a window into the very roots of modern close air support. Aspects like suppression of enemy air defenses, communication, target identification, and support for a ground scheme of maneuver are all exemplified in the book. Once again, if you have not already read this book, pick up a copy and read it. I believe you'll really enjoy it. If the book sounds interesting, you can pick up a copy on Amazon for like 10 or 15 bucks, depending on when you search for it. If you can't find a cheap copy, just wait a couple of weeks and try again. Usually you can find something for a good price within a month. Bill, now that we know a little bit about the book, how about we do a deep dive on a couple of subjects? Why don't you start us off with Rudel's record?
When I first read this book years ago, I remember Rudel was unapologetic in his Nazi views. And then I read it again, and I thought, oh, that's an understatement.
Yeah, I had the same impression when I read the book again this time. When I read it a while ago, that point never struck me. But as I read it this time, it was clear to me Rudel never changed his views on Nazism and was a believer to the end.
Yeah, because he didn't try and just paint himself as a regular guy caught up in events, it made me wonder when it was written. So look for the publication date. I turned to the front of the book, the edition that I've got, and noticed it was my edition was published by the Friends of Oswald Mosley.
That's really interesting. I looked at the publication and the history of the book as well. It was originally written in German in the late 1940s, and then in the late 1950s, it was translated into English. What's interesting to me is that Rudel had some time to reflect on the war as he was writing the book, and then before it was translated into English. And that never seemed to have any impact on him. He never changed his views that the Germans were 100% justified in their actions in World War II.
Yeah, and if a little background on Mosley, if you're not familiar with him, whose friends published the edition I've got, he was the British aristocrat. He was a World War I veteran. He became a member of Parliament. Then he took up leadership of the British fascist movement to the point that his second marriage was in Berlin at Josef Goebbels' house with Hitler as the guest of honor.
Yeah, Mosley was a real piece of work. That guy, after the war starts, the British intern him, intern being a euphemism for incarceration in prison, and he stayed in prison from 1940 to 1943, and then in 1943, Parliament voted to release him, and he was put on house arrest. But that guy, during the 30s, got enamored with Mussolini and Hitler, and if you look at videos of him, you see him giving all of the same similar hand gestures, and he gets the old black turtleneck on, and they got the black shirts running around London trying to be tough guys. It was a complete failed movement, but that guy was a wannabe Nazi from the 1930s on.
Yeah. Well, getting back to Rudel, I can't help but think he was very lucky, and I don't think he could have done what he did in the West. He was also kind of a strange cat. He didn't fit in with the rest of the gang, and I don't think it was just because he only drank milk and was dedicated to clean living.
If you haven't seen that YouTube video, there's a German Stuka pilot discussing Rudel and his relationship with him early in the war before they go into Russia. And it's well worth watching. I think we'll post it on the blog so people can get a look at it. And he is not real complimentary of Rudel. He describes him as a very strange cat who never seemed to fit in with the rest of the lads that were in the ready room of the Stuka squadron.
Yeah. Also, I noticed in the book, Rudell never saw, or at least he doesn't say so, he doesn't see how the whole thing isn't going to end well for Germany. Instead, he talks a lot about every time he meets with Hitler, Hitler's got this incredible grasp of the situation on the East, and he just doesn't seem to get his head around the idea on how it's going to end for him.
Yeah, I was struck by that as well. You know, I think in the book he describes 6 or 7 meetings he has with Hitler throughout the war. And it's usually when he gets another decoration and he goes and meets Hitler and they have a 2-hour conversation. And in each one of those, he never talks about like the deterioration of Hitler or the fact that he's starting to lose his faculties. He's always this, it's always a glowing report on how the Führer has it all under control. And the Führer would never have made any mistakes if he was just given the correct information from his underlings, but he was getting bad information. And that's why he kept, you know, making these bad decisions. He actually never even says they're bad decisions. It's remarkable. Again, this book was written after the war, and he had some time to have some perspective, but his hero worship of Hitler was to the very end. I think he died believing Hitler was right about everything.
Yeah, his whole answer just seems, he never acknowledges defeat. He just keeps getting in the cockpit and going up. He gets wounded. He just gets back in and keeps going up. He gets his leg blown off. He gets back in the cockpit and he's still flying. But he did develop skill. He got real good, real fast, and he was lethal. You can't argue with the results that he turned in. He destroyed 519 tanks. He sank a battleship, a cruiser, a destroyer, 70 landing craft. He shot down 9 aircraft with a dive bomber, destroyed 150 gun positions, 800 vehicles, blew up all sorts of trains and bridges. And he was shot down more than 30 times. He was wounded 5 times.
Yeah, the other remarkable thing that he talks about several times in the book is landing to go pick up down Stuka crews that were behind enemy lines. So he would, you know, drop his aircraft down, land on some field, pick them up real quick, and then take off. He ends up, and as I mentioned this in the book review portion, he ends up getting stuck down there and having to do a 30-mile cross-country E&E with a bullet in his shoulder, but which is kind of a testament to his belief that physical conditioning is important. But you're 100% right. He, throughout the war, continually makes excuses for the Germans' failures. It's always the Romanians' fault. It's always, we never had this. It's always the enemy has so many people. And we were just overwhelmed. If we would have just had, you know, better allies, we'd have been great. Okay, I'll give him that. But I do want to put his war record in perspective because it is impressive. It's unbelievably impressive. First, let's talk a little bit about what does 517 tanks really mean? Now, we don't know which each one of the tanks were, but I'm just assuming that they're T-34s, which was the main battle tank for the Russians. If he destroyed 517 tanks, what that means is he destroyed 8 Russian tank brigades, and a tank brigade is 65 tanks. A brigade is basically a little bit bigger than a battalion in the U.S. kind of arsenal. So if you add all that up, it's roughly a tank division he destroyed single-handedly. That's a remarkable feat of arms that he was able to pull off. The second thing I want to talk about is he constantly talks about the number of missions he flies, and it's very famous, the fact that he flew over 2,500 missions during the war. So his war lasted 1,412 days. And that's because he didn't start until the invasion of Russia, because before that, they didn't let him fly in combat because they didn't have faith in him. So in 1,412 days, he flew 2,500 missions. That's 1.7 missions a day for the entire war. So there's no breaks. Every day you're flying 1.7. Now, it didn't really work out that way, but okay. So let's put that into an American context as well, right? My dad flew with the 8th Air Force, and his requirement was to fly 30 missions. Now, he was a heavy bomber. He was on a heavy bomber, so that's a different experience. And their missions lasted 10 hours and whatever, right? But he was only required to go into combat 30 times. Now, if you a better, more accurate measure would be looking at a fighter pilot like in the 9th Air Force, a Thunderbolt pilot who was required to fly 200 combat hours before he could rotate home. So if you look at kind of Rudell's experience, he would fly 200 hours a month, easy, if the weather was okay. Easy if the weather's okay. So again, this is probably inaccurate, but he flew anywhere between 40 and 47 U.S. tour equivalents in the war. That's crazy. The last part about that is even if he wasn't flying through a hail of Russian anti-aircraft on a regular basis, right, he had to take off and land 5,000 times to accomplish that, with an aircraft that always had maintenance problems, with bad weather, off improved airfields, so they weren't like you were taking off a concrete runway most of the time. He won the Powerball like three times during the war. That's how lucky this guy was to accomplish all the flying he did without some mechanical mishap, the lucky bullet, the fighter who just somehow gets the right shot in, a bad part that just cracks when he's on the dive and he can't pull out. All of those experiences added up to this unbelievable amount of good fortune on his part to survive the war.
Yeah, well, Rudell's forte was definitely close air support, and close air support is a huge tool in the U.S. tactical toolbox, and so let's take a pretty deep dive on that.
Yeah, great. Let's do it.
A couple basic ideas with the concept of air supporting ground maneuver. Idea one, if you're going to attack something with an airplane, it's a good idea to do it far away from your own forces. That way, they'll never actually have to fight what you just attacked. Plus, putting more distance between your forces and what your airplanes are attacking reduces the chance for fratricide and makes deconflection a lot easier. Idea two, on the other hand, is that if you've got a close ground fight, it would really be to your advantage to have someone fly over and drop a bunch of ordnance on your adversary. You'd literally have their sky fall in on them. It's combined arms action with air supporting ground maneuver. Just think about the lethality one airplane can bring in one pass. Yes, it works. How this concept of close air support or CAS developed?
Yeah, it's interesting how it was developed. But going into World War II, Germany was at the forefront of this development, and it led the development in close air support for two reasons. First, Wolfram von Richthofen.
That name sounds familiar.
Yeah, he was the cousin of the Red Baron and actually fought with him during World War I. So he was a bit of a hot runner. So in 1938, he was a colonel. And by 1943, this guy was a field marshal. He was responsible for many of the innovations that led to fully integrated CAS and its application in conducting Blitzkrieg. The concepts that he pioneered helped eventually get to the point where we have terminal control of close air support. The second reason the Germans had the lead they had going into World War II is they used the Spanish Civil War as a test bed for their tactics. So during their experience in the Spanish Civil War, they developed things like shuttle attacks. The shuttle attack is basically pushing your airfields as close as you can to the front so you can cycle those airplanes onto the same target multiple times in a day.
Yeah, now this idea of shuttling from an airfield that's close by to where it's needed is one of the reasons why they played into the development of the Harrier with its vertical and short takeoff ability. The Israelis paid a lot of attention to how to shorten their turnaround time between sorties so they could generate more of them during the 1968 war, and it really helped them gain an edge over their Arab adversaries.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, there was always this picture that was indelibly stuck in my mind of a Marine Harrier out on Lyman Road taking off and landing. And the whole concept was that the Harriers would be right up on the front line. They'd go drop ordnance, come back, reload, and just keep doing that in a really, really quick turn.
Yeah, I was driving home on Lyman Road one day, and I'm driving down the road, and there's a pilot standing on the side of it, and he's looking a little bit out of place. And as I drive by, I see he's got the tail of his Harrier sticking out of the wood line. And so I stop and talk to him. I'm just like, hey, is everything okay? And he looks at me like, well, no, it's not. It's kind of a dumb question. But hey, are you okay? Yeah, he's fine. I never got the story, but he did tell me they were sending some people over to help crane the whole thing out and get it where it needed to be.
Yeah, I suspect they were sending the Aviation Safety Board or Mishap Board over there, and they were going to take his BAC right away as well. So, yeah, that was probably a really bad day for that poor guy. Anyways, the other thing that shuttling does, it allows you to create continuous pressure on your adversary. And it seems, from their perspective, it seems like they're always under aerial attack because the planes just keep coming back. And so it really does have a psychological impact on them. And it creates a situation where that just breaks their will. And you see this in the book all the time when Rudell talks about him flying against the same target, you know, 10 and 15 times a day. His airfield was right up on the front line.
Yeah, kind of an extreme example of this, I guess, would be Marine Corsairs flying off of Peleliu. They were so close, they didn't even raise their landing gear. Once they took off, they were over target like 10 to 15 seconds later, dropping ordnance and then turning back around to land, rearm, and do the whole thing again.
Yeah, there's that real famous picture of, you see that Corsair with its landing gear down, and it pickled off a napalm canister and headed right back home for a quick return. The Germans also started a thing called chain attacks in Spain. And really what that is when you bring multiple aircraft on the same target, when the first aircraft goes into the attack and drops its bomb, the subsequent aircraft use that bomb as a marker and then adjust off of it to get closer to the target or to continue to hit the same target with some level of precision. So what it allows you to do is gain more and more accuracy and more precision over time. The other thing is they would fly in these patterns where the aircraft weren't dropping all of their ordnance on one pass. They would take multiple passes, and then they get subsequently closer and closer to the targets.
Yeah, we use this today. One thing it does is it doesn't let your enemy just figure out that your air support has left scene. And we also use the idea of sequential attacks to give adjustments to subsequent aircraft, dash 2, 3, and 4, to either get closer to what you want them to hit or to adjust them onto other targets and engage from there.
Exactly. So those terminal controllers are talking to the aircraft, and they're saying, hey, it's 100 meters east of Leeds Hits, and the guy in dash 2 knows that as he's coming down, he's just going to adjust a little bit and go 100 meters east of where that last bomb landed, and you get really, really accurate on that. Plus, it allows those controllers to use those aircraft if they need to hit multiple targets, and it's easy to adjust them on. The third thing that von Richthofen did during the Spanish Civil War was come up with this concept of the air liaison officer. And what they would do is put Luftwaffe officers with the ground element, and they would act as in a coordinating manner. So they would know what the ground scheme of maneuver was. They could call back to the aviation units and talk to the Luftwaffe and say, okay, this is what the Army is going to be doing tomorrow. This is the support they would like. This is, you know, how it's going to go down from a tactical perspective, and this is how you can support it. And then the aviation guys would conduct their planning and get ready for the next day's attacks. What they found, though, was because they lacked the communications for constant contact with the aviation element, many times in a highly mechanized environment, the ground troops would go past their initial objectives. And so the air guys were trying to find them, and it was not well coordinated. So they really struggled with this lack of communication until the middle of the war, late part of the war, when they could actually talk to the aircraft from the ground. As they go into Poland, von Richthofen, what he does is come up with another concept called a tactical air coordinator airborne, or TAC-A as we call it today. So during the invasion of Poland, von Richthofen flew around in a Fiesler Storch, which is a light observation aircraft, and he would then direct the attacks on the Polish strong points. So he understood what the scheme of maneuver was, and he understood what the aircraft capabilities were. And what he did was bridge that gap and use the Luftwaffe to concentrate the maximum force at the decisive time and place and really add punch to the ground attacks scheme of maneuver.
Yeah, you read about this in the book. Rudell served in this role many times, but he was only doing it on a very small scale, like for his squadron or wing.
Yeah, and you know, as we move into today, what you see is the battlefield disperses and gets wider and wider. The TAC-A, in some ways, becomes more important than ever because they have to manage the big picture where they're trying to service multiple targets in a similar geographical area. And they have to route those aircraft in and out safely and get them to the terminal controllers on the ground in an efficient manner. Those TAC-As today also, once the bombs are dropped, they route the aircraft back out and they get them to holding points and up to tankers efficiently. So all of this takes the burden off those terminal controllers so they can focus just about putting those bombs accurately on targets that they need taken out so that the ground element can do what they need to do. Von Richthofen, as Poland winds up and they get ready for the battle with France, He spends 6 months convincing the German ground forces that the Luftwaffe can act as a maneuver element for them. And so during the invasion of France, by that time, he's convinced them that this is possible. This allows the Germans to unleash their armored columns without having to worry about counterattacks on the flanks. So what they do is they fly reconnaissance flights along those corridors and just make sure that the French aren't trying to attack them from the side. So there's a real famous case where reconnaissance aircraft spot the French 9th Army massing to attack one of these armored columns that's way ahead of the rest of the army. And they then bring Stukas and other ground attack aircraft to bear on the French 9th Army and basically decimate it before it can ever really get into its counterattack position and impact those armored columns. And you see Rudel talk about this repeatedly while he's on the Eastern Front, where you have these, in a war of maneuver, the German tank columns will be moving and he'll act in that role and protect them from the side so he doesn't have to worry about, they don't have to worry about T-34 slicing in from the side.
In 2003, the Army launched a aviation brigade. I think they were going with 31 Apache helicopters, but they launched them en masse to go hunt down the Medina division. And I don't think they actually made contact with the Medina division. They ended up flying over some pretty densely urban areas and taking a lot of small arms fire. But still, what they were trying to do was use an aviation element en masse to take on a ground element and use it as a maneuver element.
Yeah, that's exactly right. However, like I said, that they still struggle with communications, and they knew that they needed terminal control. So in the 1940 timeframe, they start doing some experimentation of putting VHF radios on vehicles and having terminal control of the Stukas and other ground attack aircraft that they had. Those experiments proved to be very successful. However, it took them another 3 or 4 years before they got the radios in place in the command tanks and reconnaissance vehicles and the people in place that knew how to do terminal control of aircraft, so that they could have communications directly from the ground unit up to the aviation platforms that were supporting their maneuver. So in 1944, they finally achieved this. And this is what everybody had been trying to do for quite some time. What the German ground controllers' tasks really were was to talk directly to those aircraft, guide them with precision onto targets that they needed to hit, and then prevent them from accidentally hitting German vehicles or German units on the ground. So you can see that the Germans were pretty innovative in this. By the 1944, however, the British, the Russians, the U.S. had all caught up to them and could all do this. I know that's kind of the history part of it, but I think it would be helpful if we talked a little bit about how do you, you know, what are all the challenges associated with planning and execution of close air support? So why don't we just spend a couple of minutes talking about what we do today?
Yeah, close air support, this is graduate level work, and our history with fratricide shows how complex it is. It's not easy, not given, and it's not perfect, and not just anyone can do it. It's such an important issue that the U.S. requires anyone actually controlling aircraft releasing ordnance be certified to do it. Even if you're a ground attack pilot, you need to go back to school to learn how to control your own aircraft from the ground. And just as an observation, the U.S. has generally been on the delivering end of CAS. I'm not saying no U.S. forces have ever been attacked by enemy airplanes, but enemy close air support has never really been a significant threat. Of all the guys in World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm, Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever else, they all had plenty of things to worry about. Enemy airplanes was nowhere near the top of that list. Now, there's no guarantee it's always going to be that way.
Yeah, here's a little story. You know, my dad fought in World War II and was on a B-24 with the 8th Air Force. Well, during the Battle of the Bulge, they were supporting the ground guys and hitting a target. Anyways, they got shot down, and luckily his aircraft was able to get back over friendly lines. He had to parachute out, and in doing that, he got injured, and he was taken to a British field hospital. And I think he was shot down on the 29th of December. So he'd been in the hospital for a couple of days. And on the 1st of January, 1945, the Germans do their last big hoorah in terms of CAS on the Western Front. Anyways, they send all these whole fighter force after the U.S. aircraft that are stationed on the continent, both the British and the U.S. Anyway, so my dad hobbles out because they got all these aircraft flying over him, and he doesn't know what's going on. So he hobbles out of his hospital tent, and this this Fokker Wolf 190 goes zorching by at like 30 feet, and the pilot looks at him, and he goes, "Yeah, that was pretty scary." And that guy wasn't even shooting at me. He goes, I can't even imagine what it'd be like if that guy was shooting at us.
Probably not what he thought was going to happen that day when he woke up in a hospital.
No.
All right. Well, the next point is, you know, our recent experience in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, they were not all that complex, and they don't necessarily represent what the future holds. They weren't peer-to-peer fights. There was no sophisticated, significant anti-aircraft threat. We were engaging generally smaller targets, and we were doing it one engagement at a time.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back at Vietnam, for instance, you know, there might be 10 or 12 major fights going on all at the same time. And, you know, you may be calling for air because you need it desperately because you're in a major fight, and it just isn't available because you're too low on the priority list. And they had to deal with that stuff in Vietnam all the time.
Yeah, also, CAS is not a panacea, and how effective it is isn't a constant. You might have, in the middle of the day, you might have great visibility from a piece of high ground, think you've got it all figured out, but if the fog or thunderstorm rolls in, all of a sudden you can't see more than a few feet in front of you. No airplanes are going to be doing anything at low level in mountains in fog, and even if they could, if they can't see the target on the ground to ID it, it's going to be a problem. Even with precision-guided munitions, you still have to see the target to get a location, not necessarily from the airplane, but from the ground. Also, the number of aircraft that we have and how much they can fly is finite. They're not just working for you.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing about PGMs that's interesting is it also allows those aircraft to release them at a much higher altitude and stay above that small arms anti-aircraft fire that everybody's concerned about. Now, in a peer-to-peer fight, they may have to come in low because the enemy has significant anti-aircraft capability, which means those aircraft are going to come in low. They're going to go into the pop, which means they're going to pop up, turn, find the target, and then attack it. So that is a very difficult maneuver.
Yeah, also, airplanes don't just appear where you need them and when you want them. The chain of getting them there goes all the way from the guy looking at the target on the ground to a theater headquarters and then on over to people loading out aircraft. Oh, by the way, all that coordination is run over battery or generator-powered radios. It's run over a 72-hour air tasking order or ATO cycle that a big staff works. For simplicity, we'll leave out talking about things like lasers or controlling aircraft flying from continents away. You get the point. This is a complex organizational undertaking.
Yeah, you know, the ATO is trying to control, in some cases, hundreds, if not 1,000 aircraft at one time. And it takes a massive staff to build that every day. It's like 1,000 people. So, you know, that document is huge. When you start looking at it, it takes up gigabytes and gigabytes of data. So like during the Gulf War, it was so large they couldn't transmit it to the carriers via radio because they didn't have pipes big enough to do that. So they had to fly out hard copies every day to the carrier. So that drove the carrier's requirement to have, you know, wideband satellite communications to get both the intel they needed and this ATO. So it changed what the carriers are all about.
Yeah, and you've got to crank out a new ATO every day. You're not just regurgitating the same thing because you have to account for things like the results from what you achieved today, weather, and changes in the ground situation. So this is something, and it all has to be generated in real time to be of any use. Also, before an airplane gets to the ground fight that is trying to help, its movement there has to be deconflicted with everything else flying through the air. Even Riddell talks about this. In other words, you can't fly your own airplanes through your own artillery or your own anti-air defenses without letting them know that you're coming.
Yeah, the ground guys always get a little touchy about this, right? Because they think they're in danger. And why can't the aviation guys take greater dangers to support them, right? So there's this whole concept of big sky, little bullet. And they talk about it all the time. But in reality, nobody wants to see a $100 million F-35 taken out by a friendly 155 shell.
Yeah. Meanwhile, while he's getting to the fight, envision the fight on the ground. You got people shooting, moving, communicating, artillery mortars being fired. Other units are close by, and they're in their own fight. And now you want to swing things in your favor by having airplanes fly over at hundreds of miles an hour and release really lethal ordnance. To give you an idea of how all these pieces have to be synchronized to get an effect and avoid fratricide, here's a walkthrough of the simplest of air missions at the point of delivery. First, you, or more likely the fire support team that works for you, has to request air support. That's going to take some time, so you're likely to start using other things like mortars and artillery right away. As long as they're in range, they can respond in a couple of minutes.
Yeah, and then when you're talking about a peer-to-peer fight, you really have to anticipate that the enemy's going to have shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles, which are really going to impact the aircraft's ability to get to and from the target. So what you have to do is build a package that supports suppressing the air defense that the enemy has that you're going to be attacking, which means you have to build a detailed fire support plan that supports your maneuver onto that target. So what exactly does that mean? It means you have to use mortars and artillery to suppress those enemy positions so that those units that could pull up with shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles can't while those airplanes are en route. Then you have to build a window in that plan so that the aircraft can get over the target, drop the bombs, and get off the target without getting hit by those suppressive fires or the impacts and fragmentation that comes from that artillery as they're dropping. Now, once the bombs land and the aircraft depart, you then have to resuppress that target so that those SAM gunners can't get back up again and shoot at the aircraft as they retreat. So you can see this is a pretty complex plan. And it really requires the use of all your suppression on those targets, in addition to using that suppression so that the maneuvering unit can get as close as possible to it without taking a direct fire from it. So all of this, these assets need to be synchronized and used in a way that allows the infantry to close with the enemy and get to them as close as possible before they engage them directly.
That's right. You got to make adjustments with your supporting arms, and you got to get all your suppression dialed in just right to have it work. And that's not instantaneous, and the airplane is still going to be flying in. So what this means is it's going to take some time. Situationally dependent, you know, plus or minus a couple, it's going to be taking about a half an hour. Now, eventually, the request that you submitted is going to move laterally to the air side, and if available, aircraft will be tasked to support you. They aren't nearby, so you're going to spend some time just trying to reach them by talking into a handset. And once they do respond, you're going to give them 9 lines of information, including target location, time on target, the route you want them to take to the area, and then out of it. And you really got to build the pilot's situational awareness so they can figure things out on their end. Now, Rudell had to do this himself. He also mentioned several times that he wasn't real sure he dropped on the right guys. And this is no small consideration, because things are going to start falling apart real fast when you start dropping bombs on yourself. All those pictures of either German or more recently U.S. vehicles with flags on air panels laid on top illustrate the point. That's why they're there.
Just do this. Look out the window when you're taking off or landing, and when you're at about 1,000 feet, try to identify different cars. Try to say, oh, that's a Mercedes sedan. I think you'll discover it's really hard to positively identify different cars at that altitude. Remember, you're only flying at 170 to 200 knots in a commercial aircraft during those periods. Imagine if you're flying 500 knots with people shooting at you. It's really, really hard to tell your tanks from the enemy tanks. Rudell had to deal with this problem throughout the war. And it's something that we struggle with today as well.
It's very hard to tell who is on the ground. If you doubt what I'm saying, go read up on how U.S. aircraft engaged Canadian ground forces in Afghanistan and inflicted significant casualties on them in the early stages of Afghanistan. And there was no ground action going on at the time. They just up and did it. Now, on top of all this, you have to make sure you can see the target and the aircraft that's going to release it. He's not going to drop unless you tell him. And that's just the basics of one pass. We didn't talk any target marking or adjustment for subsequent passes, integration to different aircraft. And you can imagine doing all this at night. But the bottom line is CAS can work and it does give you a real advantage, but practice counts. And if you can't do this in training, you're not going to be able to do it game day, and it's not a given. Now, we've got some links to some thesis papers in the blog and on close air support, and one of the authors points out that only a very limited number of countries have actually been able to develop the capability to use fully integrated CAS. Now, with all that said, we've talked a while, but we're going to cut it off here. Now, got any questions or inputs? Please send us an email and let us know.
Yeah, please send us an email on that because we'd love to have a conversation about this topic in greater depth.
So, Tony, you got a shout-out this month?
Yeah, I do have a shout-out. I'd like to have all the people listening, if you have some time and enjoy what we're doing, please Google We Have Ways of Making You Talk. It's a podcast that was produced by Al Murray and James Holland. Al Murray is a British comedian, but has a fantastic grasp of World War II history. And James Holland is a historian by trade and author. And I've read multiple books that he's written, all on World War II. And they produce a fantastic podcast on the history of World War II. And I think you'll really enjoy it. How about yourself?
Yeah, mine's to the Red Cross Blood Services Program. Someone in the U.S. needs a blood transfusion about every 2 seconds, and last year, the Red Cross helped meet that need by providing over 5 million units of blood. Now, here's another dimension to blood donation, is they really do help save lives, and they are given to strangers in need, so it really is a noble thing to do.
So in your life, how many pints of blood have you given?
Well, I'm on track. Hopefully this year, I'm going to go over 4 gallons.
Wow. Impressive. So you're doing that, what, every 2 or 3 months?
I can do it every 2 months, but normally I only get in about every 3.
Cool. And you're taking all the cookies and juice and all that stuff on the way out?
A lot of Lorna Doones packages going in the pocket on the way out. Yeah.
Well, that's a nice feature of giving blood. So do you have any save rounds for this month?
Not from my end.
Yeah, I only have one real quick. Remember, save yourself some money, support your local library. It's a fantastic resource. Next month, we're going to be covering Martin Russ's book, Breakout. It's the epic tale of the 1st Marine Division's fight at the Chosin Reservoir. I think you're going to enjoy that. And remember, if you need to contact us, reach out on Twitter or Gmail and send us a line, and let's get that conversation going. All right, out here.